This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
You're about to hear an episode of Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley. New episodes will be released weekly, wherever you get your podcasts. But if you're in the UK, you can hear the full series now on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel back in time to meet con artists, hoaxers and crooks, women who lived extraordinary lives. What can their crimes tell us about the times they lived in and about women's lives today? This time on Lady Swindlers, prepare yourself to meet a princess.
The present inexplicable appearance of a young female foreigner in the vicinity of Bristol has excited considerable curiosity.
Where did she come from? And who can she be? Did she fall from the sky? Did she rise from the sea?
An unfortunate, unprotected and wandering princess from a distant eastern island, cast upon the shores of Britain by cruel and relentless pirates.
That's right. We have a princess captured by pirates and washed up in Georgian England. But is there more to her than first meets the eye? Let's find out. It's the 3rd of April, 1817. We've just arrived in Almondsbury, a country village 10-ish miles away from Bristol in southwest England. And out of the twilight walks a young woman. She looks bone tired. She knocks at the door of a cottage and starts gesturing to the inhabitants.
The door being open and a couch in view, she made signs of a wish to repose herself. The cottagers, not comprehending her language, reported the case to Mrs. Worrell.
That's Mrs. Elizabeth Worrell, the mistress of Knoll Park, the big house on the edge of the village.
That lady kindly visited. Her language was equally unknown to Mrs. Worrell, but her appearance and graceful manners so interested that lady that she took her under her own roof.
The woman carries no papers, just a small bundle with a piece of soap and a few coins. She's wearing a black stuff gown with a muslin frill around the neck, teamed with, this is interesting,
a black cotton shawl on her head, loosely and tastefully put on, in imitation of the Asiatic costume.
Who on earth could she be? Well, I'm completely intrigued, and I'm delighted to be joined in the studio today by a woman who knows all about the twists and the turns of a story. She is a writer, a novelist, a poet, and presents The Breakfast Show on BBC Radio London. And a man on the internet has called her another shouty woman. So I think she'll feel right at home here on Lady Swindlers. A warm welcome to the wonderful Salma El-Wadani.
Hello. Thank you for that intro.
Salma, what do you think of the story so far?
I'm also very intrigued and curious as to where we're going to go with this. This woman has appeared out of nowhere. And the thing that quite fascinates me at this point is everyone else's perception of her. What is it about this Elizabeth Worrell that's decided, actually, I'm going to take a very keen interest in this woman? And as we've just heard, she's bundled her back to her home. Why would you do that to a stranger that you absolutely didn't know? And what motivations are going on there?
I get it, though, because this mysterious stranger, who is she? Is she a space alien? I mean, yeah, we want to know, don't we?
Indeed.
Thankfully, I think we're about to find out. We are indebted to this marvellously thorough local journalist called John Matthew Gutch. He's left us a really detailed contemporary account. So, first things first. Elizabeth discovers the woman's name by writing her own on paper before offering the stranger a pen.
This she declined, shaking her head and crying, "Caribou! Caribou!" pointing to herself.
So her name is Caribou. Interesting. I asked our Lady Swindler's in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, to meet me in Almondsbury on a very windy day.
Say, Ros, well, we're on a hill over the Bristol Channel. It's a wonderful view. It's also a bit blowy up here. Today I call it quite a big village, Almondsbury. It's near the M5, but its proximity to Bristol is very important in this story, isn't it?
That's right. It's absolutely fundamental to understanding the story. Bristol in the early 19th century was a major city. Now, it was Bristol's port that made it so important and so prosperous. Where Bristol is situated, right at the mouth of the River Avon, it has this access to the Atlantic, the Americas, the Caribbean, West Africa. Bristol also played a very important role in the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans. And this trade brought enormous wealth. The slave trade was abolished in 1807, so it's about 10 years before our case, still within living memory. And Bristol is still this prosperous port. There were constantly foreign sailors and travellers passing through. It was arguably the most cosmopolitan city in England after London.
In that context, can you tell me about this supposedly Asiatic headdress that the woman's wearing? Is she possibly a recent arrival to Bristol?
Yeah, it's interesting you mention that. I have brought with me a picture by Nathaniel Cooper Branwhite. Here she is.
In a sort of a turban?
Yeah, that's right. As you can see, we don't get much else. We just get her head and the top of her body. But from other descriptions, we know that she was wearing clothes, really, from the neck down that were very typical of the urban working class at the time. So it's this headdress, this turban style that she's wearing, really marks her out as someone quite different. The upper classes, the wealthy classes at this time are absolutely fascinated with representations of foreign cultures, and they have this real taste for the exotic. The Arabian Nights had become hugely popular. We find depictions of the East in the works of some of the Romantic poets. And the upper classes also had a penchant for dressing up in costumes which imitated or were influenced by Eastern dress, including turbans.
It's amazing what putting a turban on your head can do to change your appearance, whether that's, you know, a Sikh turban, a habit, a hijab. It's amazing what putting a piece of cloth on your head can do to your environment and how people treat you.
And it's very interesting that this fascination with how Caribou looks with her exotic headdress is set against an age of British imperialism. There's a profound belief in British superiority, accompanied by this fascination with foreign cultures. But Caribou is vulnerable at this point. She's been wandering around the countryside, begging for help. She's a vagrant, and that is a punishable offence. Elizabeth Wall is very kind, but her husband is a local magistrate. He takes Caribou into Bristol, where she gets put into the workhouse. But Elizabeth comes to her rescue once again. She has Caribou discharged into her own care. Every foreigner in Bristol, and everyone who's even ever met a foreigner, is enlisted to try to help communicate with Caribou. But nobody can, until she's introduced to a well-travelled Portuguese sailor. He confidently says that Caribou speaks a mixture of languages used on the coast of Sumatra. That's present-day Indonesia.
She was a daughter of a person of rank, of Chinese origin by a Malay woman who was killed in a war between the cannibals and Malays. Whilst walking in her garden at Javasu, attended by three women, she was seized by the people of a pirate prow and bound hand and foot, her mouth also covered, and thus she was carried off. Her father swam after her, and in pursuit shot an arrow which killed one of her women. She wounded herself two men when she was seized, one of whom died.
That first set of pirates, according to the Portuguese sailor's translation, trades Caribou with another crew who take her halfway round the world before sailing up the Bristol Channel. Then she jumps overboard and swims to freedom. But this changes everything. Caribou is not a vagrant after all. Her father is a powerful leader and she's a princess from the island of Javasu. Now, no one's actually heard of Javasu, but it sounds like it might be a slightly smaller island that's near to Java, right? Now, even Elizabeth Worrell's cynical husband is won over by this story. Princess Caribou now lives in his house, Knole Park, as a prestigious guest.
The drawing room is crowded with fashionable visitants, all eager to be introduced to the interesting princess.
They bring her gifts from travels abroad that they hope she might recognise. Coral and peppers and green tea and ivory fans and Indian ink. They show her books with lavish coloured pictures of the tropics and dictionaries of languages from around the world in the hope of understanding her better. Salma, it's really noticeable that her treatment gets much more luxurious once it's revealed that she's a princess.
Yeah, there's some royal hobnobbing happening here, isn't there? There's this fascination with the royal family, which we have had since time immemorial, it would seem, and that doesn't seem to have gone anywhere in modern day. That idea that you want to stand close or be in the presence of royalty and perhaps what that might do and how it could change your fortunes. We've come a long way since the 1800s, but we haven't changed much in our fascination for something that's different, that's out of the ordinary, that's not the mundane, that's not the everyday life that we live.
I wonder if we've got a sort of echo here too of the kind of virtue signalling that sometimes white people make today by being interested in other cultures.
Yes, perhaps there is a bit of that and they want to show their worldliness. But I do wonder if, just to look on the other side of it, was there anyone at the time who was genuinely interested and perhaps a scholar of other areas and wanted to expand their horizons and learn about this place that Princess Caribou perhaps came from? Maybe there was some genuine interest.
I'm sure there was. I feel like there was a bit of both and it's probably quite hard to distinguish between the two. We do know that the Worrells and all the visitors to their house at Knole Park are enthralled by Princess Caribou's unusual behaviour. Here are some of the servants reading John Gutch's account for us.
She oftentimes carried a gong on her back and a tambourine in her hand.
She refused a pigeon that was dressed and having a live one put into her hands. She cut off its head, which she buried together with its blood under the earth and then dressed and ate the other part.
Her head dressed with flowers and feathers, she made it appear she was prepared for war.
The Worrells' home, Knole Park, was mostly demolished around 1970. But one key bit of it remains, and during my trip to Almondsbury, I wanted to explore it.
So I'm climbing right up to the top of the surviving tower at Knole Park, and we're told that Caribou herself would come up here once a week to pray to a god that she called Alatala. And she also spends time out there in the wonderful gardens. She loves climbing trees. She likes swimming in the lake. She also likes fencing. She can fire arrows while running along. In fact, she's living her best life.
She sounds like she's having the best time ever. She sounds like a very capable, able, strong woman. Admittedly, there's a language barrier, but the image of a woman running along, firing arrows, that sounds spectacular.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes.
Given that this show is called Lady Swindlers, you're probably wondering what is up. Does Princess Caribou now fleece the Worrells and make off with the family silver? But no, she doesn't really seem to be after their money. She does run away twice during her stay at Knole Park, but she takes nothing with her, not even the gifts that she's been given. It's now early June, and for 10 weeks, Caribou has been protected and doted upon by Elizabeth Worrell and her wealthy friends. Then, one day, a visitor to the house called Dr. Wilkinson takes it upon himself to write about Princess Caribou in a local newspaper. Two people now come forward claiming to have met Caribou before her arrival in Almondsbury. They include Mrs. Neal, the landlady at a boarding house in central Bristol.
Begging your pardon, ma'am,
She tells Elizabeth Worrell that Caribou rented a room from her earlier in the year, that Caribou was definitely English and short of money. Caribou and her roommate used to go out begging in the city, this lady says, and found that they were more successful if Caribou dressed herself in a turban. And spoke her lingo for a frolic. Now, Elizabeth confronts Caribou, demanding to know the truth. At first, Caribou protests and panics and continues to refuse to speak English, but then this is how the Bristol Mirror newspaper captures the scene.
The Princess of Javasu immediately sunk upon her knees. This eldest daughter of the sun, this moon of moons, this inhabitant of Sirius, was in an instant fallen from her high estate and changed to Mary Baker of Witheridge in Devonshire.
Oh, my word. Now, that's rather a melodramatic account, but this was a really astonishing transformation. Princess Caribou is revealed to be Mary Baker, a cobbler's daughter from Devonshire. How do you feel about that, Selma?
I am shocked and appalled.
You're not, though, are you? You had your suspicions.
I had my suspicions that something was going on here. But I find it quite remarkable. Am I allowed to be impressed? It's quite impressive.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking cobbler's daughter, Devonshire, 1800s. That's a very working class estate that she's in. And what level of education would she have had? I imagine it wouldn't have been that vast or that great. How you spoke in society very much distinguished where you were from. To be fair, it still does. Had she been speaking English, would she have been discovered much sooner?
Of course she would. As soon as she opened her mouth, she would have been placed, wouldn't she?
And then she would have been in the workhouse.
And then she would have been back in the workhouse.
Not in the manor.
Yes, absolutely true. Selma, you're multilingual yourself. Are you different people in the different languages that you speak?
Yes, I'm going to say I am. And it's so funny that you asked me that now, because yesterday I was with all my Egyptian family and it struck me how much louder everyone is when they're talking in Arabic as opposed to when they're talking in English. Everything gets very flamboyant and the gestures get very big because I think Arabic's just a more colourful language. And I think Princess Caribou, or Princess Boo here, I think she would have been able, perhaps, to be a little bit more flamboyant when she's pretending to speak a different language. Because English is quite, and I think British society, perhaps, it's quite straight-laced.
Are you saying that we're buttoned up and repressed and uptight?
I couldn't possibly say that. Yes, yes. The stiff upper lip has gotten so stiff that it perhaps just restrains expression a little bit. So maybe Princess Caribou just thought, I can be extroverted and different in a different language. It makes sense to me.
It makes sense to me too. Well, back in Almondsbury, I had some pressing questions for our historian, Ros Crone.
Ros, this is so shocking. What can you tell me about this Mary Baker person?
Thankfully, we can verify some of the details in Gutch's account by checking them against surviving sources. So parish records tell us that she's born Mary Wilcox in 1791. She adopts the name Baker later on.
My dear father and mother, and my love and duty to my dear brothers and sister.
It seems that at a young age she went into domestic service.
My mistress treats me with all imaginable kindness. And my young missus learned me to write.
And we know for sure that she made her way to London at some point.
That's quite adventurous, Devon, to London.
Yeah, yeah. We know that she was treated for rheumatic fever in a London workhouse.
Oh.
In February 1813, she was admitted to the Magdalen Hospital for the reception of penitent prostitutes in Southwark.
Oh dear, this is all turning a bit dark.
In February 1816, she gives birth to a baby and she surrenders that child to the Foundling Hospital in Bloomsbury. And I'm sorry to say that soon afterwards, the child dies at just 7 months old.
Your most humbly dutiful loving daughter, Mary Wilcox.
So this is a very tragic backstory. A lot of suffering there. I can imagine when she turned up here that she was experiencing trauma or some kind of mental illness. But I am still a bit confused about how she got the knowledge to convince people that she was really from Southeast Asia.
One theory, which I think is very convincing, actually, is that she learns how to be caribou from the people around her. They bring books on different cultures and leave them lying about. They give her exotic gifts. And of course, they're talking all the time to each other about, you know, where she might come from, saying, well, she would do this, she would do that if she came from this place. And they are oblivious to the fact that she's listening all the time. She can understand all the words that they say.
I'm a bit curious, though, about the Portuguese sailor who does seem genuinely to understand her.
I think he might well have just got caught up in the moment and fancied 5 minutes of fame.
As her mouthpiece.
Yes, exactly.
I understand her. But how on earth does she sustain it over so many weeks?
Yeah, she was an absolutely phenomenal actor. I mean, the servants at Knoll Park were testing her all the time. She never betrays herself. There's a great story of them running in to her bedroom in the middle of the night, shouting, fire, fire, to see if she would react. And she doesn't. It's incredible.
I am wondering, Selma, if someone who was trying to escape mentally from this horrible situation that had happened to her in London, maybe it was a diversion. You know, here's something positive for me to think about.
From what we've heard, she's gone through a horrible time of it. She's lost a baby. She's been involved in sex work, which you can't imagine the experiences that she must have had back then. She doesn't want to be Mary Baker anymore. And actually, is stepping into this entirely new character, this different woman, is that actually her respite? And is that when she gets to exhale and be somebody else?
It's a sort of method of self-protection, possibly, to take on this different character in which she can bear to go on living.
Absolutely. And escapism. If your reality is worse than imagination, is it easier just to act?
There's something recognisable to us in her need to shift shape.
Yes. And I think women are always code-switching. We are the malleable beings that are always bent into so many different shapes and so many different people. As we all know, the data shows us that women are generally the primary caregivers, whether that's for children or whether that's for older relatives in the families. Women hold so many different roles. Everything that we've heard about her so far, as strange as it is, I can completely understand why she's done it. So far, I'm in the caribou corner.
Let's go back to the story. Although Mary Baker has been playing with fire, she isn't punished for what she's done. In fact, a lot of people, like Selma, hail her as a hero. They are delighted by her performance, her creativity. Elizabeth Worrell doesn't seem to bear any grudges. And in fact, she pays for her to travel to America, a place she's always longed to go. Mary Baker embarks on a kind of a new career in show business. She exhibits herself as the Princess Caribou with her Java suit outfit and her make-believe language. Unfortunately, though, it's a bit of a flop, and Mary soon winds up back in Bristol. She marries a local man and she has three more children, two of whom tragically die as infants. She's widowed in her 50s, but she and her surviving daughter carry on their family business, which is, I love this, dealing in leeches for bloodletting, for medical treatment. And they do a good trade supplying what's now the Bristol Royal Infirmary. But that's not quite the end of Mary's story.
Roz and I have now travelled into Bristol. It's still quite windy. And we've come to see a statue, but not the one you might be thinking. We've not come to see the statue of Edward Colston, slave trader of Bristol, statue erected in 1895 and then very famously torn down and thrown into the harbour of Bristol in 2020 as part of the protest against the murder of George Floyd. Roz, who have we come to see instead?
Yeah, Lucy, we have actually come to see a statue of Princess Caribou. Now, this statue suddenly appeared here in August 2022, just like Caribou appeared in Almondsbury. And it's the work of a Bristol-based artist getting up to stuff. It actually marks the final resting place of Mary Baker here in Hebron Road Burial Ground. Mary lived nearby, here in Bedminster, until the end of her life, in fact. She died on the 24th of December, 1864, and she was buried here with no grave marker. That is, until this statue appeared.
And as you come into this burial yard, it's so poignant because it's very overgrown. There are some headstones, there are creepers, ivy, the hawthorns in bloom, and then you just catch out of the corner of your eyes this grey ghostly figure. She's been represented as her full-on, most exotic Princess Caribou personality. Extravagant turban on her head, draped with jewels, and holding up a mask, a masquerade mask, to hint at the fact that there are all these layers and deceptions.
Yeah, that's right. To be honest, Lucy, part of me feels quite uncomfortable with this, because ultimately Mary was a white woman dressing up and impersonating people from other cultures, other ethnicities. But I guess there's another way you could flip this and look at it too, which is that what Mary was doing was she was taking the perceptions that white people at the time had of the East, and she was representing those perceptions back to them in a way that we might call carnivalesque. And if we think of the carnivalesque, that's been a common thread through popular culture in the early modern period, the 18th century and into the 19th century. And it's an idea of the world turned upside down in order to give people at the margins, on the edge of society, some kind of opportunity to thumb their nose at those in power, those in authority. I don't think Mary was your typical grifter. She lived this life on the margins where survival was really paramount.
Mary the swindler, Mary the survivor. What do you think, Salma?
I found that really interesting about cultural appropriation and how we look at it today in hindsight. Obviously, it's very different at the time. But I suppose it comes back to intent, and there's no malicious intent behind it. You were just grasping onto what you had around you, as opposed to doing something that would be hurtful to another culture. And I thought, okay, atta girl, atta girl. You did what you had to do. I think she speaks to perhaps the majority of women at the time, women who were trying to survive. Whether you had wealth or not, you didn't have any rights. Apart from marriage, there was no viable way to change your economic status. I think if we place Princess Caribou in modern times, she is someone who goes out by any means necessary to change her life. I've got nothing but admiration for it. I think Princess Caribou is a woman who said, "This is what I want." She was hungry and she had ambition. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Who can blame her?
Is she new? Is she old? Is she false? Is she true? Come read me the riddle of Miss Caribou.
For 10 magnificent weeks, Mary Baker, a woman with nothing, had the wealthy upper classes of Bristol wrapped around her little finger. We could only speculate about Mary's state of mind at that point in her life, and it sounds like she might have been in a very bad place when she arrived in Almondsbury. But somehow, with audacity and creativity, she pulled this off. Today, I hope that society would have helped Mary out a bit more, hopefully sending her to drama school so she could have a proper life on the stage. I also do quite like to think of her settled down in a quieter, later life in Bristol, selling leeches and perhaps reminiscing about her glory days as Princess Caribou. A huge thank you to our guest detective Salma El-Wildani and our historical consultant Rosalind Crone. Next time on Lady Swindlers, we're off to Australia to meet gangster Tilly Devine, queen of Sydney's 1920s criminal underworld. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Sarah Goodman, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series by searching for Lady Swindlers on BBC Sounds.
Imagine a scrap of data that could help rescue a man lost at sea.
That far north, most people aren't found. This is a race against the clock.
Or expose staggering financial fraud.
All the Swiss banks, the British banks, the French banks. What I was looking at was a horror show.
Or uncover a medical breakthrough.
Within 10 years, the whole world was convinced that he was right.
10 extraordinary adventures of data and discovery. Uncharted with me, Hannah Fry, on Radio 4. Now available on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation, spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.